Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
We're trying to break our record all the time. We're starting earlier and earlier. Good evening and welcome to Word in Your Ear. You've probably noticed, I'm David Hepworth, you've probably noticed that there's a space on the sofa where normally there's a lanky, voluble Mark Ellen, who's unfortunately not very well. So we all send our best wishes to Mark. He'll be with us soon. And so I'm holding the fort this evening. I hope you'll forgive me. And I hope you'll also enjoy the benefit that since Mark's not here, we can be finished by about 8:30. I'm sure you'll agree. So tonight's proceedings are in two parts. In the second part, we're going to be talking to John Savage about his book about 1966. But we begin with Howard Sounds, who you're probably familiar with from his biographies of Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney and, Rose West, I think, as well.
Yeah.
And I will not draw any parallel at all between that and this latest book, which is Notes from the Velvet Underground, The Life of Lou Reed. Would you please welcome Howard Sounds?
Thank you.
So, Howard, you approach rock biography probably not in the way that most people do. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. I mean, I was a newspaper journalist, which is why I wrote about Fred and Rose West. For about the first 10 years of my career. And then I just started writing biographies because I had the luck, the good fortune to break the Fred and Rose West murder story back in the mid-90s. So then I wrote the book about it. The book was a success. I really enjoyed writing the book. It was a great experience. And I thought, well, this is what I want to do. I don't want to be a newspaper hack anymore. I want to write books, and I want to write serious books. And so then I wrote a biography of Charles Bukowski, the American writer. And then I just try to pick people whom I was interested in. And Bob Dylan was the first musician of those, and that was a success. And so when you've written a successful book, you tend to try to repeat that formula, I guess, to some extent.
So with the Bob Dylan book, that was quite a story, because you broke a piece of information that wasn't widely known before then. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah. It had been rumoured for years that Bob had been married more than once. I mean, I think most people knew that. But he's very, very secretive. I mean, he lives a very secretive life, places cards close to his chest. And I wanted to pin down how many times he'd been married and to whom. And the first wife was famously Sarah of Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands and Sarah and all those great songs. And I just went, every time I did an interview, I did about 250 interviews for the Dylan biography, I asked people, well, you know, what about Bob's second wife? And then I got a first name, and then I got a second name. And then I went downtown to the Los Angeles County Court Archives, and I went through the marriage records until I found her. And so then I broke, which is in itself just one page in a 400-page biography, but it made a lot of noise.
Yeah.
You know, Bob Dylan's secret marriage is a natural story.
So how many years of marriage certificates did you have to go through?
Well, I narrowed it down by speaking to people because people remembered vaguely when Bob was married and when... This is Carolyn Dennis, who was one of his backing singers. So people remembered vaguely when Carolyn was on the scene and they had a child together. And I worked out the age of the child. I think I got the child's birth certificate first. And then when I knew when Desiree, their daughter, was born, then I could look in the right years for the marriage. And then one day I just happened to find it. And indeed got the entire divorce file. The LA County Court gave me the whole file, which was stamped confidential. But either because they didn't care.
God bless America.
Or they weren't reading, or they were just bored. Because, you know, clerks in courts are a terribly dreary life. They just said, oh, here you are. And I went away and read the whole thing. My eyes were bugging out of my head. I wish I had the little secret camera I could photograph.
So you say you talked to 200 and some people in the course of doing that. Did you talk to his family?
Yeah. To my great surprise, I wrote to his children by Sarah. Well, I think there's five by Sarah. Samuel, Jesse, Jacob, etc. And one of them wrote back and said, well, come and see us.
No.
Yeah, and so I went, and this is one who's he's a movie director in Hollywood, one of Bob's sons, and he said, come to see me, and I went into this swanky West Hollywood production studio with sort of fake grass and fake palm trees in the office, you know, typical wacky place, and a big conference table, and there were Bob's kids, and there was a glass screen at the end of the room, and I was sure Bob must, surely he knew about this, I was thinking, he must, perhaps he's sitting behind the screen, you know, how can his kids have invited me here to talk about Dad, and Dad not know about it. But I don't know. I presume he wasn't there, but he never showed himself. But the kids then spoke, you know, about Dad, and it was fascinating because, of course, you know, Bob's kids see Bob Dylan quite differently to everybody else. I mean, he's Dad. He's the guy that taught them how to ride a bike and took them swimming and
so was that on ice skating. Was that on condition that you didn't attribute the quotes?
Yeah.
So it was just, it was background.
They just didn't want to be known. They didn't want to be identified.
Right.
Yeah.
Saying anything rude about Dad, as would happen in any family, I suppose.
It was a little bit vague, but I didn't identify them by name. That was my understanding of our agreement.
Okay, so that's Bob Dylan. Your latest one is The Life of Lou Reed. Is there any coincidence the fact that you've written this after he's dead?
Well, no. I mean, I guess that's why I wrote it, because it presents a publishing opportunity. You know, publishers react to the news, as we all do, and when somebody dies and they see all the headlines and all the coverage, they say to themselves, "Oh, we must have a Lou Reed biography." Now, I said to them, "I said, look, Lou Reed never sold any records. You know, journalists like Lou Reed. That's why there's all these long obituaries. You know, journalists love Lou Reed. I love Lou Reed since I was 14. But Joe Public is not interested. You know, Joe Public is not going to buy this book. It's not going to be a big seller. But they, nevertheless, they react to the news. They see the front page of The Guardian. They think we must have the book. And, of course, they commission the book. And here we are, 2 years later.
So how do you approach this? Similarly, you talk to 200 people?
Yeah, I mean, a bit less, 140. I mean, again,
how do you get in touch with them? You just email them.
That's, as you know, one of the hardest things is actually finding people and then convincing them to talk to you. I mean, that takes an enormous amount of time, and it's very frustrating. And then, of course, you have to do a lot of travel. They're all in the States. You have to go to the States and travel, and this is very expensive. I mean, I was thinking today of the trouble I went to interview Mo Tucker, the Velvet Underground drummer, who's a very eccentric person, lives down in a tiny town in Georgia, about 4 hours outside of Atlanta, and doesn't answer the phone, even though I had a phone number, and doesn't reply to emails. So, or maybe replies to one email in 10, you know. So I get a recommendation from somebody, I send her an email, she doesn't reply, I wait every day, I'm looking at the email box, has she replied, is she going to reply, can I dare send another email, and yet not seem too pushy. And then finally she replies and sort of gives me the vague understanding that if I come to this tiny town in Georgia, all the way from the Barbican, where I live, in London, she might just see me, if I'm lucky. And, you know, that's a very expensive thing to do. But, of course, she's a very important person. So I went and I drove for 4 hours from Atlanta and checked into the local Holiday Inn in this horrible town, you know, with the worst food you've ever had in your life. You know, I've never seen so much bacon. And every other building is some kind of evangelical church.
It's a Bill Bryson town.
Yeah. I mean, I had some of the worst food I've ever had in my life. And yet there she was, you know, living.
So she turned up.
And nobody in this town knows who she is.
So she's how old now?
She's she's younger than the others, but she's about 68.
Oh, okay, right. So with Lou Reed, let's go back to the beginning, and I've taken the liberty of finding some pictures of for a bit of background. You know, we always associate Lou Reed with the mean streets of, you know, Manhattan and Harlem and so forth. That's the house he grew up in.
Yeah.
So this is Long Island, is that right?
Yeah, this is Freeport, Long Island. And Long Island, as you may know, has a ritzy, fashionable part. Well, it has several. It has the Hamptons, where all the millionaires and billionaires live. And it has the North Shore, which is where the Great Gatsby was set. And it has the South Shore, which is a bit like the London Borough of Bexley, in fact, where I'm from. And this is the South Shore. This is Longwood Avenue, Freeport. And it's your classic 1950s American three-bedroom detached bungalow. I mean, with cladding. And it was, you know, Lou told the Melody Maker in 1976 that he was the son of millionaires, which was a lie. And he also, of course, gave the impression he was a sort of child of the streets, which was also actually a fiction.
Well, it's all rock stars do this, don't they? They all imply that they're raised by wolves and so forth.
Absolutely.
Actually, in truth, and they usually, all come from houses like that.
I mean, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. They all come from houses.
They're lower middle class.
I would like to do a big picture book of rock stars' homes, where they grew up and then where they ended up.
Yes.
You know? And we'll follow that line this evening. So... just give us an idea of his bedroom.
This is probably his bedroom, actually, just down the back here.
Yes.
By the way. And when he quit the Velvet Underground, he went back here. This is where he retreated.
So it's the same house in 1971.
Absolutely. At the end of all that amazing music.
We'll come to that in due course. That's interesting. So his parents were, was it Sid?
Sid, an accountant, and Toby, a stenographer.
Right. So very conventional, kind of small businessman.
Well, he was a certified public... he was an accountant.
Right.
Certified public accountant.
Right.
Jewish immigrant stock, lower middle class, suburban
people. But he had a very tense relationship with them.
Well, Lou, of course, one of the key events in Lou's life is he has a complete nervous breakdown in his freshman year at college at New York University at the age of 17. He just has a complete... a crack-up. Not quite... no one really knows why. And he retreats to the family home, and his parents seek expert advice, and the expert advice is that your son's suicide, or he needs electric convulsive therapy, electric shock therapy, which then was quite fashionable, and is still actually carried out today. It's not a thing of the past. But he went through the ECT, very traumatic, and he blamed his father for it. And probably unfairly, because Bunny, his sister, whom I interviewed for the book at some length, says that, the parents were just trying to do the best they could. They followed the advice they were given, but Lou resented it forever afterwards.
Which resentment being a theme that runs through this book all the way through.
Yeah, and he becomes a very bitter, angry, resentful, chippy man.
This is him at a high school.
Yeah.
Lewis, full name.
Lewis Allen Reed, yeah.
Tall, dark-haired Lude likes basketball, music, and naturally girls.
Yes.
Of which more later.
Brackets, and boys, of course.
He was a valuable participant on the track team. He's one of Freeport's great contributors to the recording world.
Yeah.
As for the immediate future, Lou has no plans, but will take life as it comes. So, was it a fairly happy school? Well, apart from his... the school years, was that quite...
He was clever, introverted, a bit difficult, a little bit shy. He had girlfriends, but he was... he had an issue about his sexuality. He had trouble relating to girls, I think. I mean, surprisingly, he was on the track team. He did sports and he did conventional things, and he actually ranked quite highly in his year. I mean, he graduated sort of in the top 10%, I think.
So he goes to university. This is Syracuse University.
Yeah.
There he is in a very fine piece of knitwear in the middle.
Yeah. And looking quite happy.
Absolutely.
High school band.
Is that the Kingston Trio or something like that?
This is, I forget the name of the high school band, the El Dorados.
Right.
L.A. and the El Dorados. Okay. El Falou.
So from early on, he wanted to play music. Is that
fair? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And wrote. I mean, that was the big thing. He wasn't a very good guitarist, never was, although he said that he was as good as Jimi Hendrix. He was a pretty limited singer. I'm sure you heard him and saw him. He was a pretty, he sang like Rex Harrison sang. He narrated his songs, which is fine. I thought that was great. But really, he was a writer, and he wrote from when he was at school. He wrote short stories. He wrote poems. He was one of those rock and roll poets of the early 60s, Leonard Cohen, Bob Dylan, Lou Reed.
So at Syracuse University is where he has the breakdown and...
No, he has the breakdown at NYU.
Okay.
Freshman year, then has to quit NYU, and then starts all over again the next year at Syracuse.
Oh, okay, right, fine. So... I think he's first. If we come to this next, if my iPad works, this is his first brush with the music business.
Yeah.
Now, how does this work? He gets a job with Pickwick music publishers.
So when he's at Syracuse, a guy comes up to Syracuse one weekend, who runs a small record label in suburban New York called Pickwick, and he says, "Lou, I want a songwriter to write pastiches of pop hits. So pastiches of surf songs, biker songs, whatever was fashionable in vogue in 1966 or 65." 65, 64, and come and work for me. This guy's called Terry Phillips, and Lou goes to work for Terry Phillips after college, writing pastiches of Beach Boys hits, Beatles hits, whatever's fashionable.
Making up dance trends.
Yeah, and then he invents his mad dance called the Ostrich.
I think we can hear it by the miracle of YouTube and Terry.
All right, everybody get down.
So that's how you do the ostrich, ladies and gentlemen.
And he's singing that. And he's drunk, by the way, or stoned when he's doing it.
It's a fantastic sound, though, isn't it, really?
Is it?
Yes. Yeah, no, definitely. It's one of my favourite Lou Reed songs. I've only heard it while looking into this. So how does that lead to the Velvet Underground?
Well, I mean, the legend is, and I guess it's true, that the guy that ran Pickwick, Terry, wanted a band to take this terrible song out on the road and promote it, to actually appear in public, because Lou and his colleagues in the studio, which was just like a warehouse with one mic, they recorded it, but they weren't personable enough to actually go and stand in high schools and supermarkets and shopping malls and promote it. So Terry hired... remarkably enough, John Cale, alumni of Goldsmiths, friend of John Cage and Yanis Xenakis, you know, the leading modernist composers of the day, a protege of Aaron Copland, no less. He hires John Cale, who he meets at a party, Lou, two guys from Harvard, by the way, who are friends of John's, to form this make-believe band called the Primitives, who ostensibly perform the Ostrich, which is his first sort of entree into show business.
And how's that become the Velvet Underground?
Well, the other two, you know, soon wander off, but John Cale sees some talent in Lou, likes his songs. He's already written Heroin, he's already written I'm Waiting for the Man, and John sees a way to arrange these songs, because he was writing these songs but performing them on acoustic guitar in the style of Bob Dylan. I mean, he was under the influence of Bob Dylan, as everybody was, but John Cale saw a different way of bringing modernism to this, you know,
right.
the drone, the ideas of the avant-garde, Lamont Young, making the song slow, as he said, slow and sexy and mysterious and dark. And, of course, that's what that was his brilliant contribution.
Because that's one of the points made in the book, and I can't remember, there's a quote from somebody who's contrasting John Cale and Lou Reed. That John Cale could do everything.
Yeah.
He was a genius.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And Lou could do one thing.
Yeah, and without Lou, you know, we wouldn't have heard of without John, we wouldn't have heard of Lou Reed, probably. And I think that he resented that. You know,
right.
He resented that.
Well, yes, because... So this is the kind of, you know, I always had the feeling that if you're in a successful group, you're married to them for all time.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you do. And this is a very complicated marriage with all these people, isn't it? Because obviously, you've got Andy Warhol. So how does Andy Warhol get involved?
So, well, they meet Andy. Andy's looking for a band to put on at a disco. And his oppo, Gerard Malanger, sees the Velvet Underground performing in the Village, in Greenwich Village. And he says, Andy, come down and see these guys. They're pretty outlandish. The drummer's a girl, Mo, which was at the time virtually unique.
Well, I don't know. The Honeycombs had...
Well, I think that's the only other example, isn't it?
Okay.
You know, this guy is playing a viola on stage.
Yeah, that is unique.
As though he wants to break it. And then you've got Lou singing about heroin, of course, and songs like the Black Angels Death Song. And then you've got dear old Sterling, who's sort of strumming along on the side. And Andy thought they looked pretty cool, and so he hired them. And that's how we get... the Velvet Underground. And then he puts Nico together with them, because Nico has independently come to New York to try to get into the American music business.
So she's very much the front person of the group.
Yeah, because...
At that time. She's the star.
Yes, because she's been in Fellini's La Dolce Vita, and she's made a record in London, and she's got a bit of a name, and she's very beautiful. She was a Vogue model. And these guys were all completely unknown.
So the fact that she's very beautiful did not escape Lou's attention.
No, so, you know, I mean, Lou's butt was bisexual. Now, Lou would never use the word bisexual, but the facts speak for themselves. You know, he had lovers of both sexes. And I think also opportunistically, it was a way, as one of his friends told me for the book, of controlling the situation. Now, he didn't want Nico to run the band. He didn't want her to sing his songs. I think by having an affair with her, he was a way of somehow controlling her and putting her sort of under his wing.
Okay. So tell us about the relationship between him and Andy Warhol.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that Warhol taught him a great deal. I mean, Warhol, of course, was a great genius, master of media manipulation, gave Lou lots of good advice, told him things like, you don't have to tell journalists the truth, you know, which is, a key bit of advice for an aspiring rock star. And of course, Lou was you probably interviewed him, was a famously difficult interviewee.
Well, we've discussed on these very sofas many times in the past that Lou Reed hated journalists. Always talked about how he hated journalists, and it's my contention that no human being in history paid so many PRs so much money to put him in rooms with journalists than Lou Reed, because all he ever did was talk to journalists.
Yeah, and
that's how he did his PR. There was no advertising or whatever. When he came to tour, he'd be in some hotel abusing a trail of journalists going in and out. And usually the young ones wrote, glowing pieces. I've just been given a hard time by Lou Reed. Whoopee, I've joined the club, And the older ones wouldn't go anymore, But that's what he did.
And did you find him obnoxious?
I didn't interview him, but I met him a couple of times. The warmth didn't come off him, I think that's fair to say.
No.
You'd have been, with him a long time before the bonhomie would have, come out there. But, it's like lots of these people, I think it's a point you made earlier, that they are kind of shy underneath it all, and it manifests itself in a sort of arrogance, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think insecure about his sexuality, very thin-skinned, hated bad reviews. And let's face it, he made some very bad records. I mean, albums like Sally Can't Dance, Rock and Roll Heart. I bought all these albums when they came out. I was
you
a
didn't.
Fan. I took them home and I thought, why did I spend £5 on this record? There are Lou Reed records that I've barely listened to this day because they were so bad.
So you never learnt. So you're always trying to rediscover the thrill of Transformer or whatever it was.
Because the first one I bought was Transformer and it was brilliant. And I thought, they're all going to be like this.
Fundamental, elementary mistake in popular music. I think that people can do it again.
It took me about 20 years to work out that I was on a high on to nothing.
Right. So, but anyway, they go on to make, this is the first album.
Yeah, and of course this is all brilliant. The Velvet Underground was...
So what's on this one? Has this got... Venus
all
first.
The classics, all the classics. I'm Waiting Heroine. For the Man, Heroine, Black Angel's Death Song, Sunday Morning, all the classics. And the book is called Notes from the Velvet Underground because I think the Velvet Underground is really Lou's claim to fame. The quality of the work he did with John Cale, and I think he needed John Cale to do that, do work that was that good, was so much better than the work he did as a solo artist. And so much more inventive and brave and interesting, and has lasted much longer.
So everybody acknowledges this as a classic, but my memory is at the time it came out, nobody bought it at all.
Well, yeah, indeed, nobody bought it. I mean, but a few key people, people like famously David Bowie and Chris Stein from Blondie, people like that, heard it, loved it right from the start. The cognoscenti, as it were, the up-and-coming generation knew it was a masterpiece. And I think, but it didn't sell. And I think to this day, it's probably sold maybe, Lou's a lawyer was telling me that he think it sold 3 million copies. Which seems actually quite optimistic, but over 40 years around the world.
Was he bitter about the fact that he hadn't sold?
Oh, I think so. I think they all were. I mean, Mo would say that she couldn't believe it. They go to play a town like St. Louis, or they go and play San Francisco, and they go into the local record shop, and they couldn't, and their record wasn't even in the racks.
Oh, well, they always say that. Let me tell you, it was in the racks in Dewsbury in Yorkshire, gathering coats of dust. Acts always say, our record wasn't in the shops. It's a standard excuse, but you may have been right in that case. So they go through their ups and downs.
Yep.
This record comes out in late 1970 in the States and 1971 in the UK. By then, he's left the group.
Well, he finishes this. He half finishes this album, which has some great songs in it. Of course, Sweet Jane and New Age, Rock and Roll, of course. But by this stage, he's really there's a guy called Doug Cale. Doug Yule, who was really becoming the new front man of the band. There's a problem with the manager. Lou falls out with all of his managers, by the way, throughout his career. He has this, he has hatred. He hates his managers almost as much as he hates journalists.
Like Van Morrison.
Yeah, very standard.
It's amazing that Lou and Van never got together.
And you know, he quits. He just quits. He quits one evening at the Maxis Kansas City, and he has a breakdown. One of the things I found out, which is new in the book, is that his sister Bunny, who knew him longer than anyone, and actually stayed in contact with him. She didn't fall out with him, almost uniquely. So she knew him right throughout her life, whereas he fell out with his parents and almost all of his friends. She said he had another nervous breakdown, a second nervous breakdown, just when this album came out, and that's when he went home again. And this was after 5 years of leading the Velvet Underground, having made, some of the best music of the 1960s, having made no money, no one knew who he was. The week of the Woodstock Festival, they were playing a roadhouse in Deerfield, Massachusetts, to 30 people. Yeah. I mean, the guy must have been completely devastated.
Yeah, I was the tiny bit detail that I read about him going home was that his parents came and picked him up.
Yeah,
they drove him from Long Island to pick him up on a street corner in Manhattan, and it was like a boy has gone to college and it hasn't worked out.
Yeah, and I think he relied on his parents much more than he let on. You know, he gave the impression that his father was a complete brute who abused him and beat his mother. But actually, you know, Lou was in close contact with his parents throughout his life. His dad did his books in the 70s, went through his books. You know, his dad was an accountant.
Quite. Nothing wrong with that at all. So he goes home to Long Island and has pretty much turned his back on it, hasn't he? At the time this record comes out, to pretty good reviews.
Yeah, I mean, this becomes a lawsuit because of the way the songs are credited to the band rather than him. And he's really washed up. No one will touch him. No record companies want to touch him. He has this nervous breakdown. He's in his late 20s, so he's no longer exactly young. He's no longer pubescent. I mean, one of the things Andy Warhol liked about him was that he was cute and pubescent, as he said in his words.
But not anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah. Now he's a rather grumpy man pushing 30.
Yeah. And along comes David Bowie.
Well, yeah, there's a first solo album which is absolutely awful, which is one of those records I bought and wish I hadn't, which has got that Fabergé egg on the cover, if you know it, which is just terrible. And no one bought that. That was a flop, and he was lucky to get that album out with RCA. And then by, you know, the greatest good fortune, David Bowie, who just signed to RCA, loved the Velvet Underground, said to RCA, look, I will rescue this man's career. I will produce him, me and Mick Ronson, and we'll do a good job.
Because you know the story about David Bowie going to see him in going to see the Velvet Underground in 1971 in New York. He's out there doing a press trip, and he decides he's going to see the Velvet Underground because he's heard all about them. He's really enthused. And he goes to the gig, and he manages to get backstage, and he raves on at the singer, thinking he's talking to Lou Reed. And he's not. He's talking to Doug Yule.
Yeah.
And but it's an interesting point.
The Velveteen Underground.
Because people's pictures were not seen all over the place.
No.
They were not on videos or anything like that. There was a great mystique about these kind of acts, you know. But he was definitely the guy that, you know, both Lou Reed and Iggy Pop were both on the points of giving up when David Bowie came along.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, rescued his career, really.
So that's the record.
That's the record that
I first
heard.
So that's 1972, is that right?
72, yeah. 73, okay. Just the cusp of. And, of course, it yielded this hit single, which wasn't really a monster hit. I think it was number 2 in the UK, number 9 in the
US. So we're talking about Walk on the Wild Side.
Walk on the Wild Side. Sounds nothing like anything else he ever did.
No.
I mean, doesn't sound like him. This doesn't even look like him, by the way, this Mick Rock photograph. I mean, he didn't look as good looking as that. He didn't sound as smooth as that, but a beautiful production job by David Bowie.
And of course, the great Herbie Flowers on the bass.
Herbie Flowers was wonderful, you know, overdubbing
the bass.
He got
paid £25.
Yeah. And, you know, the thunder thighs. These three girls whom I met and who, by the way, are all white, by the way.
Yes.
One of them lives in retirement in Cambridge.
So, Thunder Thighs are retired, living in Cambridge. That's great.
One is missing.
Oh, really?
No one knows where she is.
So, presumably, a member of Thunder Thighs is going down to the post office in Cambridge picking up a pension.
Yeah, and she sued Lou when Walk on the Wild Side was used for a Honda ad, and he didn't pay her a royalty, and she sued him.
Yeah.
And won.
But it is extraordinary that, you know, the luck that attaches to these things, because in this book it says that, you know, Lou was hardly there in the studio when they were making these records.
Indeed. I mean, Ken Scott, who was one of the Beatles engineers and engineered David Bowie's albums, says that he was completely stoned, non compos mentis.
Yeah.
This photo, by the way, was taken at the Scala in King's Cross. So it's all very local. And, of course, Transformer was made in London.
So I just wanted to touch, as long as decency allows us, on the subject of Lou's sex life.
Yeah.
And tell us about this relationship.
Well, this is, I just think, fascinating. I mean, Lou, as I say, was a bisexual. He was married three times. But then in the mid-70s, he met this guy called Richard or Ricky. No one really knows his name. No one knows his surname. He's a transvestite. They met in a bar when Lou was completely stoned in New York. Ricky was from Philadelphia, we think, a hairdresser by background. And Ricky had this alternate personality, I guess what now would be called a trans personality, as Rachel. He rarely dressed in full drag, though I think he is here in full drag. As you see, he was bigger than Lou in his heels. He was also a good fighter. He was very handy at gigs. When the gigs got too rowdy, he would, he would push people out of the way. And he loved Lou. I mean, I think it's a love story. And 3 years into this relationship, here in London, after playing the Victoria Theatre, they went to a nightclub in Jermyn Street, a gay club in Jermyn Street of the day, and they celebrated their 3 years together with this wedding cake. So really, this is a faux marriage, actually. And you see that Lou actually looks a little bit abashed, I think, even like he can't quite believe he's doing this. But, you know, he does love this mad kid, who had a lith, by the way. I would call him Lewis.
So was Lou married to a...
Well, if you call that a marriage.
Was he married to a woman at this time?
No. So his first marriage was to Betty, whom he called the cocktail waitress, who was a kind of an actress in New York. His second marriage was to Sylvia in the late 70s. And his third was to Laurie Anderson, of course, the famous performance artist.
Right. We'll come to this. So I just had to share this. This is a very sophisticated piece of artist promotion from New Zealand, the rock and roll animal.
Yeah.
I'm sure he would have been thrilled when he saw that. But he did turn into kind of late 70s post-rock and roll animal. He was a big kind of boogie monster, wasn't he?
Well, RCA promoted him as the rock and roll animal, the Phantom of Rock. This was just a crazy made-up PR, because he was kind of dark, maybe, and a little bit unknown, and he wrote about the streets and about drugs and transvestites. So he was his persona was the rock and roll animal. And I think one of the themes in the book is that he, unfortunately, in the 70s, allowed himself to degenerate into self-parody.
Right.
Rather than, writing, proper music and good songs, he kind of hid behind the image. And for a while there, he was simply the image, this guy with the black glasses who used to shoot up on stage, or pretend to shoot up on stage, just to sort of live up to this PR image that had been created for him.
So what was his kind of drug, drink, regime?
Well, right through his life, and contrary to what he would like you to think, he was an alcoholic, and right up to the end, he was drinking. And it's no coincidence that he died of liver-related problems. I mean, he ruined his liver with years and years of alcoholism. He tried heroin at college very early on, when he was actually a teenager, but his drug of choice was methamphetamine. And he used to tell his friends, "I'm going to take meth every day for the rest of my life. It makes me feel like Superman."
Because you talk about one incident in the book where he tries to get this prescribed, doesn't he, by a doctor?
Yeah, and so on tour in Europe, his favourite trick was to go to a hotel. So he'd book into Rome, he'd ask for the hotel doctor. Hotel doctor would come, he said, "Look, I'm depressed, I need some uppers."
And then what do you mean you're depressed? You're Lou Reed.
And they would give him some drugs. He'd say, "No, I don't want those drugs, I want the good drugs." Then he'd get out a pharmacological reference book, and he would show the Italian quack the exact drug he wanted, which was a very, a strong amphetamine. And then he would get a prescription, which meant he could take it through customs.
So he's successful in doing this.
Yeah.
So he knew what he was doing. So this is one of the... You can't talk about Lou Reed without briefly touching upon Metal Machine Music, which gets reissued every 10 years, and we get learned pieces in the papers saying it's been much, much misunderstood.
Yeah.
Has it been much misunderstood, or was it understood perfectly?
Well, I mean, I think it was. I mean, it's amazing that you still meet people to this day who tell you that it's a great album and it's a sort of work of avant-garde art. I mean, it's four sides of completely random feedback, and it was made as a fuck you to RCA because Lou's contract called for two albums a year, and as Michael Fonfara, his sort of number one guy at the time, told me, Lou said, look, I haven't got enough songs for another album this year to RCA. They said, well, you still owe us another album. So he said, right. And he went upstairs to his bedroom, literally his bedroom, hooked up a guitar, turned on the tape recorder, left the room.
And the record was made in his absence.
And the record was made, yeah. And that is the record. Four sides of it.
His relations with the record companies were never good at all.
No, he
tried everybody over the years. He never got on with anybody. I think there's an incident in here where you talk about Charles Leveson, who used to run Arista in the UK.
Yeah,
he was
a
very mild-mannered person.
Yeah.
Went for a meeting with Lou.
Well, and according to the PR who was there, Howard Harding, whom you may remember, Lou pulled a gun on him. Why aren't my records, why aren't there posters of for The Bells? His album was The Bells at the time in London, 1979. Why aren't I seeing posters for my album in London? And, you know, as artists always say these things. And Leveson said, well, Lou, we're doing our best. And he pulled a gun on him.
A gun.
And he often pulled knives on journalists. Yeah.
He pulled all kinds of weapons on all kinds of people, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, just about every member, you interview a lot of people who've played in his bands.
Oh yeah,
over the years. And they all talk about, oh, of course, Lou stabbed me.
Well, he wouldn't. I mean, I don't think he was really a fighter. He was a poser. So he would pull a knife. At one ludicrous occasion over breakfast in Holland, he got hold of the butter knife and sort of, you know, waved it at the Dutch journalist. I mean, you're not going to do much danger with damage with a butter knife.
So, but anyway, all bands eventually reform as a large enough check.
Yeah.
And was it 1993?
Yeah.
When they came back together?
And Vox had a great front page headline, Vox magazine, so glad to be back under this picture or a similar picture. Because it was misery for all of them.
Was it really?
Lou made it misery for all of them. Because Lou was a star. Mo was retired working for Walmart, if you can believe it. Sterling was piloting a tugboat in Houston. And John Cale was doing his avant-garde music, brilliant though it is, no one buys it. Lou was a star of a type. And Lou just made their lives a misery. Even Mo, who loved Lou, was his best friend in the band, told me that he drove her absolutely crazy. And she wished that Sterling would punch him.
So when they flew over from the States to play in the UK, where it started, did Lou flew first class?
Lou flew first class in the bubble of the 747, and they were all in the cheaper seats, sort of downstairs and at the back.
Crushed in at the back.
Lou had a bodyguard, nobody else did, and Lou had the, you know, the sort of the $10,000 sound system, special effects box, and, you know, Sterling didn't even have a guitar at this stage, you know.
He was a big one for technology, wasn't he? He was a sucker for...
Absolutely.
Tell us about...
Well, he was what they call in the business a gearhead. He loved gear. He loved microphones. He loved guitars. And he was borderline autistic, I think. So he would all night long, he would sit at a mic in his apartment in New York and play a guitar. You know, maybe 10 inches from the mic, 6 inches from the mic, 4 inches. And then he would write all this down. And he would get his roadie to keep lists of all these things. It was a kind of mad, autistic experimentation with the technology. But actually, paradoxically, he was no good at using technology. I mean, he couldn't even use the internet. He had
to
have someone to help him.
Well, that tends to go along with rock stars, that they can't use mobile phones and the internet and whatever. So anyway, the big love of his life.
Yeah.
Laurie Anderson,
wonderful, yeah. A wonderful person, I think. A great artist. As great an artist as he was at his best. And probably a match for him. And I think it's fair to say that by the end of his life, he'd mellowed somewhat, though he could still be absolutely obnoxious. And, I mean, right at the end when he was dying, I mean, he did an event rather like this in New York, and people were talking at the back, and he suddenly said, "Shut up!" You know, in a really nasty, aggressive way.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just a ball of hate.
But so there's a nice story in here. I think it's Bob Gruen takes a picture of the two of them together. Is it Bob Gruen? And he wants a copy of it, which he...
Well, he said, Bob Gruen, the rock photographer, takes a picture of Lou and Laurie and sends them to Lou as a kind of, you know, a friendly sort of PR thing to do. And Lou writes back and says, you know, thanks, I gave them to my mum and she's put them on her wall. You know, that makes mum happy. And if mum's happy, I'm happy. You know, so we see a different side to him. Of course, he wasn't always a complete shit. I mean, that was part of what he was. He could be a monster, but he's complicated. The reason one writes these books is about, you know, he's an interesting man. He's an interesting subject. You know, he could be, you know, he was very up and down and, you know, very sensitive, I think, overly sensitive. And often the aggression was a way to defend himself.
It's interesting that you say he never really had any hits after Walk on the Wild Side or Transformer or whatever. But if you keep going long enough, you do eventually become quite wealthy, don't you?
Yeah.
In this kind of game.
And he lived most of his career in a terrible financial muddle. But in the last 20 years, there was a big hold-up in his royalties from the 70s due to a legal dispute. All that money started to flow through, and when he died, he was worth about $30 million. You know, a huge surprise.
So that was the house that he was living in Long Island.
Well, that's
I think.
Where he died. This is, I mean, one of the things.
The estate agent's advertising. Yeah, if anybody's interested.
Dion, the singer, said to me, "Look, this is funny. Lou always said my greatest fear in life is the suburbs. You know, I left the suburbs as soon as I could, and I'm never going back." But, of course, what does he do in his old age? He buys a house on Long Island, where he grew up. And this is the house. Now, actually, it's in the Hamptons. So this isn't the shitty London Borough of Bexley.
There's no riffraff here.
This is Kensington. This is right at the end with Paul McCartney next door and all these guys. But actually, he dies here, and he dies in the garden, more or less, in the back here, with Laurie holding him on a Sunday morning in October 2 years ago.
Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Too poetic for words. Well, it's an extraordinary story, and it's an enthralling read, and there's copies of it outside if anybody wants to buy one, and I'm sure Howard would be delighted to sign it if you did. Would you please thank Howard Sounds?
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.